Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of the first episode of Liberty and Friends, the first episode of 2020. As I've missed you guys. I hope you guys have had a wonderful festive season and you guys are back at work, obviously. Some of you perhaps not liking that. But we would really love that because the state of the economy is absolutely terrible. So hold on to your jobs, people. Hold on to that income. Again, welcome to the first installment of the Liberty and Friends show for 2020 as we look to do really big things with this podcast and have it syndicated on, or the plan at least is to have it syndicated on community radio stations across the country as we spread the word of liberty in communities that have never heard this message before and are actually held back from hearing alternative views by the very sort of politicians I always talk about and rail against on the show, which is the sort of gaggle of leftist and trendy lefty politicians in this country. You know, if we're really going to change society, and you guys hear me talk about a lot about this, we actually need to be in the battle of ideas and get into the spaces where we're not heard very often and we are underrepresented, even though ironically the ideas we espouse are very popular in communities. I mean, the idea of placing power and resources into the hands of families and individuals, you know, who doesn't want that, except of course the wily coyote that is the politician in this country. But this is not a rant session for Big Daddy Liberty. I have a very special guest on the show, someone who I really, really admire when it comes to just the sheer consistency of ideology. You know, his ability to take a lot of these concepts that we talk about and place them into very simple everyday English, often at times drawing from a millennia, if you will, or a century rather, of thinkers. You know, some of them, you know, if you read their material yourself, you might be lost and, you know, because of just how difficult, you know, it is. But he's able to bring all of that into a wonderful conversation that allows us, the lay people, to be not only inspired, but to learn. And that's what I want this first episode to be. You know, as we set out the year, the 2020 year, there's three things that I've done with my show in the first sort of week, in the various shows that I produce, from Blacks Only, which comes out every Monday on YouTube, to the Big Liberty Show itself, the flagship show, which comes out every Wednesday, and Liberty and Friends, this podcast, which comes out on a Thursday. You know, in the first week of these shows, what I've done is set out, you know, what does 2020 hold for you and for us South Africans, both or in three areas, three core areas. Obviously, the economy, like what's that going to do? Is it going to serve you and your family, or is it going to be more of the same, where the state becomes ever increasingly bigger and bigger and sucks up all the resources like a Hoover vacuum? And on social issues, you know, will we see more of the same culturally, where these sort of leftists are infiltrating all the social and public spaces that are meant to protect all of us, but are now ever increasingly becoming, you know, the purview of certain identitarians, whether it's race or gender, whatever the case may be, and they deny others the freedom to articulate who they are. They deny others the freedom to articulate ideas that are not seen as, you know, part of the orthodoxy, the often leftist and identitarian orthodoxy. And of course, politically, you know, what will these politicians who I talk a lot about on the show, you know, whether I malign them as trendy lefties or, you know, SJWs, whatever the case may be, but what are these politicians going to be doing? Because they have effectively centralized power in our society to a point where we need to now pay attention to what they do, because what they do affects our lives. So those are the three core areas that I wanted us, or I set out perhaps in my shows, you know, with various thinkers, from Ian Cruikshanks, Gabriel Krauser we had on the show. So you can check out the material on my YouTube channel. Remember, you can find that by searching Big Daddy Liberty on YouTube. Or you set out the economy, what it's going to look like. And of course, with Gabriel, we had that conversation about what some of the social issues may be for 2020. And of course, you know, with other thinkers, we've looked at other things on my Chai FM show, that comes out every Tuesday at 9. You know, we spoke about what the year might look like politically, And what I've done for this show and my special guest who I made mention of earlier on is one of the writers and analysts and legal researchers at the Free Market Foundation, Mr. Martin van Staden, who, again, as I said, is a, in my book, a respected voice and an authority when it comes to all issues liberty related, whether that's through the lens of an economic view on liberty, social issues, political issues. And he's the kind of guy I wanted to have on the show to set out, hey, who are we as liberty-loving individuals? What does it mean to be a liberty-loving individual, whether you are a liberal, classical liberal, libertarian, or even an anarchist? What does it actually mean? And really, what is the battle that we're going to be waging in South Africa in terms of the battle of ideas? Where should we be on certain issues? What should we be advocating for? What are some of the loud issues that we should be fighting for? And of course, as we submit, I'm going to do what I always do on the show. I'm going to play the role of the trendy lefty, and I'm going to pepper my guest with all sorts of usual talking points and tropes that we hear from the left in this country. And we'll see how, and we'll hear how rather, a liberty loving individual responds so that you can also be armed with the arguments in whatever space that you are in. And guys, I've waffled on for 6 minutes. I really want to introduce my guest, and he's chomping at the bit to get involved in this conversation. Remember, guys, you can support the work that I do by becoming a friend of the IRR. This is our crowdfunding campaign. We are wholly dependent on you and your support. By sending 90 Rand a month to our campaign, you can do that, of course, by SMSing your name to 32823. An SMS will cost you 1 Rand. Terms and conditions do apply. Or hey, if you're part of those tech-savvy individuals, and you're part of the, as the politicians love to talk about, the fourth industrial revolution, no, then find us online at irr.org/join. And you can support the work that I do here at the IRR, and of course my other colleagues, whether on the Daily Friend and our other shows. Guys, without further ado, let me welcome the head honcho himself, the man who I think you're going to hear a lot more of on the Big Liberty Show, Mr. Martin van Staden. Martin, hello, hello.
Hey, welcome for having, thank you for having me. It is excellent to be here on the show. I've been following it for a while now, and you do great work, and it's a privilege.
Homie, it is a massive, massive privilege to have you on, and I'm a little disappointed that I haven't had you on before, because I do think, I do think your contribution to who we are as liberty-loving individuals in this country is understated in most cases. You know, from your writing, because you've been doing this for a very, very long time, and it's people like you who often make an argument online, on social media, that, you know, people need to follow and pay attention to because of the consistency. You know, there are people who, in fact, I used to be in that category. You know, when you're in certain social spaces or political spaces, you get swept up by, you know, the current, you know, or the flavor rather of the moment. But it's always, you know, one always needs those individuals who are compasses that you can always come back to, and who will guide you back onto, you know, what is it? What it means, excuse me, to be the liberty-loving individual that we say we are. So, Martin, let me not waffle on and on and on. Let me first begin by saying or asking, who is Martin van Staden and what do you do?
Oh, well, yeah, so just on that point you made, I mean, people are afraid of this word, ideologue. Now, I happily describe myself as a libertarian ideologue, a classical liberal or liberal ideologue. I think that if the ideology that you've chosen is morally and principally correct, then you should have no qualms about being an ideologue, being a market fundamentalist, oh dear goodness, or a radical, or something like that. I think we should be proud of that, as ideologues in this camp. But yeah, a little bit more on me. So, I am a lawyer, a jurist by training. I am currently pursuing my master's degree in law at the University of Pretoria, where I also got my my undergraduate, my LLB, in 2016. And it was there where I became a so-called libertarian. I used to be a social democrat. But then for the first time after school, I actually met real socialists. I've described myself as a socialist, but I never met them. And talking with these people, I was like, geez, you're really evil. And I couldn't reconcile myself with being in that camp because they just believed in naked violence. Violence against people all the time, consistently, and no choice on their part. And I said, wow, this isn't going to work for me. And yeah, I was introduced to liberty through the anarchist school, Murray Rothbard. But I'm more of an anarchist now. I believe in a limited government, a limited state, because the uncertainty that comes with anarchy is something I don't think is terribly desirable.
don't let Pierre Casey hear you say that.
We have this conversation very often at the office. Yes. I've really delved into liberty from a legal perspective, and also working at the Free Market Foundation as the head of legal, as I do. What I concern myself with mostly is doing submissions to government on legislation, telling them just how inconsistent it is what they're proposing with the values that our society is supposed to hold dear under the Constitution, but also just as ordinary, decent human beings. Mm. The idea that you constantly want to interfere in what private people are trying to do with their own lives, I think there's something almost perverse about that. Mm. It's weird that you just constantly want to be involved in other people's business. Mm. I mean, I'm actually at a loss for words for it at that, how weird that is. And that's the point that we make. And also this idea that our Constitution is in fact, not purely libertarian, but very much libertarian. And, the way our courts and our government have construed it to be is very socialist. Mm. And I think that's a great loss to us. And I see it as partly my job to rehabilitate the Constitution in the image of the liberal institution that it is. It was the liberals who basically created the environment for the Constitution to be drawn up during the transition. And a constitution is a liberal instrument. Constitutionalism is a liberal product from John Locke, I think you can basically say, being the first constitutionalist. And he was 100% liberal. So, yeah, that's the summary of what I am and what I keep myself busy with.
And I want to unpack a lot of these areas because I think they speak to what I was making mention in my opening, which is, you know, it's that consistency in allowing a lot of us who operate in the space of advocating for freedom, advocating for liberty, to go back to and go, okay, where am I straying here? Mm. What's the, so I want to put a few questions to you and I want to see how you sort of hash them out. So, we live in a society which is ever increasingly seeing those who centralize power, whether it's in the world of business, in the world of politics, often those two are very intermarried in how they do it, ever increasingly appropriate for themselves the ability to say what should and shouldn't be in society, often at the expense of yours and my freedom. We're going to talk in specifics just now. Mm. But I want you to set out broadly, why is liberty important, Martin, and what does it mean for someone to live in a free society? What does a free society look like in the broad sense of how a liberal, classical liberal and a libertarian would look at this issue?
Okay, so briefly, let me summarize, I think, the two broad approaches to liberty. I think the first one, which will bore most people, is the philosophical approach. Yeah. So the idea is we are self-owners, we are born, we're independent, we don't have a hive mind, I think, unlike bees and ants. We don't know what we think. We don't know exactly what our fellows need, what they want. It's impossible for us to know. We can never know. And that speaks to us being entitled to control what we do because we are the only ones who know what our own interests are, who know what we need and want. Other people may get an idea of what that is, but we will be the only people who know 100% what it is that we need, or at least what we want, which I think is enough. So that's the philosophical basics of liberalism. Yeah. Self-ownership started with John Locke and some other people. They articulated this very clearly. We're simply entitled by the nature of our being. This is the idea of a human right. We have these rights by virtue of our humanity. Not how human rights are seen nowadays, mind you, but human rights in the very original sense. But then there is, I think, the more exciting aspect of it, the second approach to liberty, and that is that it just works. It works everywhere it's been tried, I think, without any exceptions. Now, people may point to robber barons and all these things, but you'll always, if you really investigate those situations where liberty apparently did not work, work, you'll find the state somewhere. The state is doing something that is causing it to quote unquote not work. But if you look at the Index of Economic Freedom, I think there's two, one by the Heritage Foundation and one by the Fraser Institute, both simply show that where markets tend to be freer, people tend to be richer. And I think the most important metric in that regard is that it shows the poorest 10% in those societies, the very poorest of the poor, are, I think, about 8 times wealthier than their counterparts in the most repressed societies, economically repressed societies. So it's better to be poor in a free market. Now, that may seem counterintuitive. Many people will think you want to be poor where government is just providing food and welfare and everything, but that's simply not the case. The freest markets are the best places to be poor. Now, yes, it has turned out that the freest markets today tend to be also be the markets with large welfare states. Yeah. Scandinavia, parts of Europe, the United States is up there as well. But that's certainly part of a free market. But if you have a unregulated market, as they tend to have,
yes,
you get money for your welfare state.
That's
now,
right.
I'm not endorsing the welfare state. I think it's a bad idea. But if you truly want a welfare state, you need a free market. You need an unregulated market.
For if it. I can just quickly interject there, because often when you have these debates on social media, you'll have that individual that says, oh, but what about the Scandinavian countries? Yeah. You know, they're socialist. And, of course, they start citing their big fangirl. What's that lady from America? Ocasio-Cortez, yes. You know, who waxes lyrical about this notion of democratic socialism, democratic socialism, and how, in terms of our case, they'll argue South Africa needs to be a democratically socialist nation. But he's made the apt point, haven't you? Which is, as it relates to how that money is generated for all of that redistribution, it's out of essentially great amounts of economic freedom.
Yeah.
They don't even have minimum wages in some of these countries, Martin.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, the way I often put it is that you can't have a regulated market and a regulatory state and a welfare state at the same time. That is what South Africa has been trying in earnest for the last few years. We have doubled down on regulations in everything. I mean, they're nationalizing sports, for goodness sake. And they're increasing taxes. I mean, I think I read this morning that there's going to be a surprise tax increase and increase in VAT in April. And they're increasing welfare. They want to, the governing party, I think, had a big billboard somewhere, I think when it was celebrating its birthday, that so many millions of people are now on welfare, and they're celebrating that. So, I mean, that's, you can't have these two things at the same time. Now, if you want to make the so-called pragmatic argument and say, well, people in South Africa are very poor, we can't just rip welfare from under them, I am happy to hear that argument. I think that welfare needs to be phased out consciously, and there needs to be progress in that direction. But fair enough, we can't take it away immediately, but we need to deregulate, and we need to deregulate hard and immediately. So Eskom is the prime example that it's on everyone's lips right now. We need to allow people to provide power for themselves and for their neighbors in a relatively unregulated market, and it would be great if we could get rid of Eskom and privatize it in the process, because government has now shown over the last two decades that it's simply totally incompetent when it comes to producing power. And we can't point to Europe and say, but it works there. State-owned companies work there. The message that libertarians try to give over to statists, for lack of a better word, is that you need to look at the lowest common denominator. You need to look at what would happen if we had an incompetent government. And South Africa is the great case study. So if that European country did get an incompetent government, the exact same thing would happen. That will not happen in a free market, because it's decentralized. There will be various power companies, and if one fails, sure, some people will be inconvenienced, but it won't be a catastrophe like it is here.
How I want us to structure this conversation is in three major parts. We'll take the issue of freedom and liberty and break it, view it through the lens of these three areas. So we're going to look at the economy, how we structure a free economy, if you will, we'll look at some social issues as we sort of, there's been some stuff that bubbled in the news cycle in the last week. And of course, we'll look at politically. What is a free, what does government look like in a free society? And then we'll end off with me playing the leftist as I disagree with all of this, and see how you deal with that. So let's begin with the economy. Martin, you really touched on some key areas and key topical issues that have been a major problem. So, Martin, the South African economy right now is in the doldrums.
Yeah.
You know, any forecast of growth is 0 point something in most cases. Even the World Bank and the IMF are beginning to pay attention and go, no, these guys are really in trouble. Mm-hmm. What has been at the heart of the collapse of the South African economy? If, as a libertarian, you're looking at this, and you have free rein to look at the various issues that we've gone through. Mm-hmm. But someone might say to Martin, yeah, but Martin, hang on, dude. The ANC has made a lot of progress, as they have on social, on socioeconomic issues, providing housing and all those goodies. Mm-hmm. All they just need to do is double down on all this and spend and print the money that we need, because we've got the money, as a lot of lefties would say.
Mm-hmm.
We just need to print more money so that we can spend on these social programs. Mm-hmm. But Martin, what's wrong with this assessment and what got us to where we are?
Okay, so let's start with what's wrong with the assessment. Printing money is a terrible idea. I think Weimar Germany tried it. They had hyperinflation. That's, you can maybe point it out and say that's part of the reason for the Second World War. That's a disaster. Our friends to the north, Zimbabwe, tried this because they ran out of money. They needed to pay their soldiers. They couldn't because the money that they printed was worthless.
Yeah.
Because if you have more of one thing, a scarce resource being money, it becomes worthless. One rand is worth less when everyone has a billion rand in their pockets.
Mm.
And very topical now, I think Venezuela has tried this. They have printed money. Just like in Zimbabwe, people cannot buy an apple with a cartload of bolivars. So printing money, I think even to the left, should simply be out. It's so obviously a dumb idea. What they are keen on now is this thing about redirecting pension funds to SOEs. Now, they think that's going to work, but that's the coming to what has gone wrong, and that is you've just told foreign investors, you've told local investors, your money is not safe here. We don't care about your interests. We care about our political interests, and we will seize whatever we want from you in achieving our ideological goals. And this is an evil ideology. So in that case, being an ideologue is very bad. It's evil. So that has been the problem here. It's a lot of uncertainty, but I don't want to say that uncertainty is a problem, because it's quite certain that this government has no regard to property rights. And I think any foreign investor who invests in this country now is stupid, to be quite honest with you.
But then Martin, I think I'm going to play the role of the lefty quite early. But then Martin, the lefty, would say, property rights are just being a right winger, Martin. Property rights are not that important. As long as the state controls all property, it can then decide who gets what. And I trust politicians, Martin, because I'm a lefty. And if Malema says, or Flo Chivambo or Cyril, Ramaphosa say that they'll take from you, Martin, the rich person, and give to me, the poor person, which obviously then deals with inequality, then why is that such a bad thing? That's good for the economy, Martin, isn't it?
No, in the first place, our history here in South Africa disproves that. This is exactly what government has been saying in this country since the end of apartheid, and probably arguably before that as well. That hasn't happened. And it comes down to this fact. Politicians are human beings. Human beings are imperfect. We have our own agendas. Every person has their own agenda. And we have incentives that drive us. There is no altruistic gene, I guess, that just drives people like Julius Malema to just want to share the wealth among people. He is a politician. He has an ideology. Now, his agenda may be very simple in that he wants to enrich himself, or it may be ideological. He wants to satisfy the various tenets of Leninism. Now, it rarely has anything to do with uplifting the people. And then we come to the calculation problem of Friedrich von Hayek, the great classical liberal Nobel laureate in economics, and that is simply that they cannot know. A politician in a central planning room cannot know over a big population what people need, what the economy needs, what needs to happen next. They cannot know. So them planning this whole thing out, saying we're going to seize land from you and give to you, it doesn't work. As we've seen with the restitution process so far, the idea in the head of the politicians is that there's this hunger for land. People just need land because they want to be subsistence farmers. the practice has disproved that. When it comes to restitution, people say, give me compensation, give me the money so that I can get off rural land and I can go into the city where the opportunities are, where recreation is, where the whole world is moving into cities. We don't want to be rural farmers. Yet this narrative has gripped us that land is going to be the solution. But all experience is against that. All principles of economics just go against this leftist notion that property rights are unnecessary. Property rights sets your jurisdiction over the world. Mm. But if you have this idea of common property, which is what the more radical leftist parties want all land to be owned by the state, you have this massive common property. You take away those incentives. You only make the incentives for the politicians relevant. Your incentives as a small-scale farmer to sell produce and make money off it, become prosperous, that is totally irrelevant. It now matters what the bureaucrat in the land office thinks about it, and it's never going to align with your interests.
No, Martin, you're wrong. You're wrong. Remember, you're wrong because I'm a lefty and I know everything. And in the left, Martin, we basically suggest that once something is owned by the people, right? Mm. This concept of the people, nebulous concept anyway. Once something is owned by the people, then the people get to decide, Martin. Mm. It won't be Julius Malema who makes the decisions. It'll be us, the people. And real wealth, Martin, comes when we own the land. Once I take the land from those productive farmers, whatever race they may be, by the way, because people think that it's just targeting whites and no. Mm-hmm. Once we take things from those who have essentially, and we redistribute it equally amongst everybody, and everybody has a nice parchment of land, a hectare somewhere in South Africa, whether it's in rural the rural Karoo or Houghton somewhere, then in that equal society, everybody becomes rich and the economy hums because we all own the land. Martin, isn't that true? Isn't that what the economy needs to get going?
No, so none of that is true. So on the first point about we decide, we the people, the common property, funny enough, that's not just a leftist idea, but a lot of people on the right have similar ideas about the commons and we need to take care of the commons. I mean, it's all nonsense. So the one thing that I've alluded to so far that just blows the commons out of the water is the tragedy of the commons. I think many listeners will be familiar with it, but in summary, basically, if you own something, for instance, a hectare of grazing land for your cattle, you're going to want to make sure that your cattle does not overgraze the land so that it can keep grazing the land and that you can keep making money off it. You're not going to use it up in one go and then your business is closed. That is private property rights. You have this incentive to take care of your land, to not destroy it, to not exhaust it. When it's a common property and you're a common farmer along with many other farmers and the only person who decides sits in an office 100 kilometers away in Pretoria, then that falls away. That is not your grazing land, and you're going to want your cattle to graze as much of that as possible before your neighbor comes and grazes his cattle on that. You're going to try and extract as much benefit from that as possible because at the end of the day, you are not paying. So that is the tragedy of the commons in essence. Common property gets destroyed because of its common nature. Just a quick example, the NHI is another very real example. Once you take private medical care and you make it common, people are going to sit in lines at hospitals because they're not paying for it anymore. And that is going to destroy the system. You're going to have a cough and you're going to be like, well, it's free. So I'm going to go to the hospital. Mm. You're not just going to try and sleep it out like many people do nowadays. So that's just one example. On the democracy point, we decide. That has, since Athenian days, not been the case anywhere, and it's totally impractical unless your state is about as big as 20 people. Mm. It's simply not going to happen that we the people decide. It's always going to be we the politicians decide. Mm. There's a term, diminishing consequences in democracy. The greater your population, the less of a say you have. This is simple mathematics. Unless parliament becomes massive and unsustainable, there are just too many practical problems in this we the people decide story. It simply doesn't happen. And then just on the land, we see societies like Monaco, Andorra, the smallest countries who have virtually no land or it's all mountainous land, they have the highest standards of living. Hong Kong, up until quite recently, unfortunately, highest standards of living in the world, mm-hmm. no land whatsoever. So to tie land and wealth so closely together is simply to ignore the facts. Now, you may make the argument that land in South Africa is very tied up in cultural identity, and I think that's probably true for everyone, and that is why, as liberals, we absolutely believe in restitution. Mm-hmm. If you can show that this land was seized from my family 100 years ago, and I want it back in my family, then yes, you need to get that land back, absolutely.
Because that's an issue of justice.
Yes,
it's just. Not social justice, no. But actual justice.
Yes.
And I agree with you with that, because, and I think it's important that you raise that point, because you often hear people say, oh, you libertarians, you liberals, you right-wingers, you don't want to have the land brought back, so to speak. Mm. But their concept of bringing the land back is a social justice definition. Yep. The idea that by virtue of me being black, Martin, I'm entitled to, to land, because the thesis is white people and whiteness. Mm-hmm. These concepts you hear a lot from social justice warriors stole the land, in inverted mm-hmm. commas. In fact, you have political parties who trade on that slogan, like, yeah. White stole the land. And it perverts the real justice then, doesn't yes. it? The idea that actually there are individuals in this country yeah. who can trace back with hard evidence and, yes. A rational way of proving something mm-hmm. that they had land stolen, but they get lost in the whole nebulous idea that blacks are entitled to land.
So that's a massive problem of this whole narrative. So there are three concepts at play here. There's restitution, justice, everyone. The African customary law, Roman Dutch civil law, English common law, everyone agrees that there needs to be restitution. Nobody is saying no restitution. Then you have redistribution and you have nationalization. Now, redistribution means that we're going to take land from someone and we're going to give it to someone with no relationship to that land for a political reason, their identity, or just because they're poor or something. And nationalization, of course, what the far left believes, and that is just the land must be owned by the state for the benefit of all people. Now, the fact that all three of these terms are in this debate really confuses it mm-hmm. because government almost exclusively uses the rhetoric of restitution. Mm. It says the original sin, it talks about the land must be given back, and all of this is restitution, and we agree. But what they're angling for is at best redistribution, and at the very worst, nationalization. And as you say, these real victims who can show that they've had land seized from them, their story gets totally lost in the political nonsense that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the point is often brought up that you can't prove it. You can't prove that this individual's ancestor's land was taken. And as a lawyer, I need to call nonsense on that, because the apartheid government at no point thought that what it was doing was evil. The Nazis at some various points knew that what they were doing was evil. The apartheid government thought that what they were doing was extremely fair. And as a result, they took meticulous record of all the land that they expropriated. Not only did they take meticulous record of it, they published it in the government gazette every That's single right. time they expropriated black land. They said, be on notice. The government is expropriating this plot in this district. Make representations if you want. Mm. And all the government gazettes from the beginning of the Union of South Africa are available. Mm. It can be proven. It can be very reasonably, easily proven.
Absolutely.
So restitution is very possible. It's within our grasp. It's there. We can do restitution and finish it within a very short space of time. But government has an ulterior motive.
That's
it
right.
wants to control the land. It wants to, and it does. The property it's already taken that had to be restituted, it still owns. Government still owns that property after many years. So it's an agenda is clear.
Well, let me support your point. I mean, there's a case right now of a Northwest farmer who just won a court case where the court said, look, guys, you've been promising this man you'd sell him this piece of land that he's been working on and you gave him as part of restitution, redistribution, inverted commas. Mm-hmm. You promised to sell the land over to him so that he has a title deed. Mm-hmm. He's already shown that he's, he works the land, he owns the land in every sense of that word. But the state fought tooth and nail to deny this man property rights. And worse yet, with the court now having ordered the sale of the land at a agreed price back then, I think it was 50-something thousand rand, the state now suddenly says, the very same state that argues we shouldn't be using market-related appraisals for land, and the state should decide the cost of that, is now arguing in this case, no, we're going to sell the land to this man, but we want market price, and that's over 50 something million rand, I think, for the land.
Yeah.
Now, it's that inconsistency. And the point I think I made on social media, just commenting on this, is to say that inconsistency is textbook the state, number one, firstly. Mm-hmm. Number two, if you had any illusion that the government and it, with its various policies for wanting to redistribute land had the intention of there being a black middle class that works land and is productive, if you had any illusion that that's what the goal is, then you should see in this case of Mr. Rakgase that that's actually not the, they don't want an independent property owning prosperous someone with property rights. They want to control that individual and have a bureaucrat tell them what is and what isn't. A quick comment on that before we move on.
So I mean, on that, property rights are supposed to direct incentives and then to an extent control incentives. Now, let's say government redistributed land and said, okay, we're going to do this for the next year. Everyone who gets redistribution land, so-called, gets total property rights over that. As a libertarian, I would say that is theft, firstly, but it's fair enough. Because you're actually going to give those people property rights, and that's going to be the end of it. They're going to be owners. Government goes away. Now they're owners, and they have incentives, and the land is going to get worked, and things are the economy is going to pick up. I'm going to oppose it, but it's not going to be as tragic as what they're actually doing now. So what they're doing now with expropriation without compensation and the watering down of property rights as a legal concept in this country is that you're going to receive land and you're going to become the so-called owner. But the legal regime says that the government can seize that property from you, even though you're a so-called beneficiary, at any time and basically for any reason that it deems to be in the public interest. And that is where the big problem comes in, that even if government was doing what it said it was doing with redistribution, it has no respect for property rights. Now, if it really believed in ownership as much as it did, as much as it claims to be, we need to set right the skewed patterns of ownership in this country because ownership is important. If it really did, then this would be a inconvenience for now with a potential prosperous future. What they're setting us up for is a future of conflict. Continuous conflict and no development. Because if I know, if I'm a beneficiary and I get this massive farm, it's great. I'm not going to invest in that farm knowing full well that the system that I received it in allows anyone to just come and say, I have to get this farm now. So it's a very precarious system. It's a very opportunistic system. You can see it's based on very short-term political objectives. It's impossible for the long term. And again, we cannot stop pointing this out in support of our narrative. It hasn't worked anywhere. Expropriation throughout the world is tied with compensation, and the only single time that property is expropriated without compensation as a norm universally is if you're a convicted criminal, then your property is taken without compensation. So the fact that government is doing this, it's 100% setting us up for a catastrophe. There is no doubt about that.
And again, and I just want to quickly put a bookmark here. Guys, we will have Martin on the show quite regularly. I know we're sort of all over the show right now, but I just want us to have a frank, open conversation. So you see how we sort of, our ideas pervade into very, very many areas of society. Martin, a lot of what we've just discussed now really does impact on the potential of any society's economy, the idea of secure property rights, allowing the market and individuals in the market great amounts of freedom and autonomy to be able to do what they need to do to create the wealth. And that wealth then, if that's the sort of government you are, is what you then redistribute in welfare, but ideally not. You want people just to be wealthy, period, in your society. We've spoken about the economic imperatives of our ideas. Let's look at some of the social issues. We won't spend too much time here. I want to use, I'll cite a recent example. First things first, a libertarian, a classical liberal, a liberty-loving individual, how do they view social issues? Are we the sort of people who want to get involved in people's lives and direct who you can marry, who you can have sex with, what racial grouping you can belong to? Is that who we are as liberty-loving individuals? Who are we, very briefly? And then I'll give an example that we can work off.
Yeah, so a libertarian, it's actually a very narrow political view. The essence of it is that you reject the use of violence to attain goals. You believe that property rights should determine who can make a decision in certain circumstances. That applies socially, that applies culturally, that applies economically. So my feeling is that libertarians tend to be more inclusive, more progressive. That's the tendency amongst our mentality. We believe in decriminalizing prostitution, decriminalizing drugs, not just because it's coercive, but because we really don't care what other people do. So there is definitely a progressive streak in our mentality. There tends to be. That's not to say that there aren't many conservative traditionalist libertarians, and that's perfectly fine. But that's the tendency. But at the end of the day, where the rubber meets the road, what we care about is the use of coercion and violence. And in most cases, that comes down to law. So when it comes to these social issues, we basically say the law has no place to direct any type of social behavior. In fact, we say the law must not recognize marriage.
Mm.
The Marriage Act, or people, there's this big boo-hai around the world about, oh, but we must recognize gay marriages. No, we must recognize no marriages. It's a contractual phenomenon, and it needs to stay there. It needs to stay in the community, stay in the religion, stay in the church, stay personal. The government simply has no role there, and that's on the broad what libertarians believe. It's that government has no in law, we'll call this locus standi. There's no standing to even be involved in this phenomenon. So yeah, no control of speech other than the immediate threat of force, which is part of the act itself. But other than that, total freedom is the real liberal position.
And I want to put something to you as I'm sort of hearing a little bit of feedback in the mic. My apologies to you, listener, if you can hear it. There is then the imperative of essentially, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but most of us libertarians actually hold the notion of live and let live. The idea that let the next person lead exactly the sort of life they want to lead, as long as they're not infringing on my freedom to do exactly the same, and vice versa, of course.
Yeah.
And this was a big issue that came up in the news cycle rather recently. Mm. And I did say before the show, I was excited on here. There was a case in Cape Town of a venue. I can't remember its name, but essentially this venue that basically said, look, we, the owners of this venue, are conservative Christians. Mm-hmm. We don't believe or want to associate ourselves with same-sex marriage for religious reasons. And on that basis, we've opted for our business to reflect our values.
Mm-hmm.
And they politely, there's no acrimonious, they weren't mean about it. Look, politely, they declined, I think, a lesbian couple from using their venue. And I think for a second that sort of was like, okay, cool, whatever. Mm. But then obviously social media picked it up and it became this big brouhaha with the predictable media, the mainstream media coming in again, saying, you know, feigning, of course, being objective, but really holding a social justice view on this. Mm-hmm. No, how dare they? Mm-hmm. You know, how dare these people discriminate and deny these other people their right to a wedding, same-sex wedding. Don't they know the Constitution makes this illegal? And because it's illegal, the state must step in, the conclusion, of course, on their part, the logical conclusion on their part, the state must step in and punish these individuals and force their business to either A, serve people who they don't want to associate with, or alternatively, close the business down. Now, Martin, I'm going to let you, I'm going to give you the first bite of this cherry, because I literally went befork on social media basically saying that is absolutely not the kind of thing you want to do.
Yeah.
But set it out for us, Martin. Why should the state not be given a place in regulating, or rather choosing winners and losers, so to speak, in the situation?
Yeah, so let me do the legal part briefly. This is what I alluded to earlier about how we view the Constitution. Now, Pierre de Vos and company are going to totally disagree with what I'm about to say, so don't use this in court, but this is what I think the actual Constitution says. So Section 18 of the Constitution says that everyone has the right to freedom of association. There is no proviso there that says unless prohibited by law or unless limited in this way and that way. It says everyone has the right to freedom of association. Yes, Section 9 says that everyone has the right to equality. But Section 9, too, and people like abusing this provision to justify affirmative action. But what it says is that everyone has the right to full and equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms. That is what Section 9.2 says. That refers to the rights and freedoms in the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights has no such thing called the right to marry. It's not there. So to rely on the Constitution in this case would be incorrect. Discrimination does not come up here. What has happened in this situation was that the venue owners have exercised both their property rights, Section 25, and their right to freedom of association. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with their decision, to be totally open with you. I think it's bad form, even as a Christian. Mm. I think the market knows only the color green in the U.S. It's money.
You and I both in that regard? Yes. In terms of the
So I disagree completely. I think it's a bad move. But using the force of the state against these owners is a total injustice. And it's probably going to there's probably going to be some threats, and there's going to be a fine or something, or an apology. That's totally wrong. The state must be totally uninvolved. And the fact is that there are many venues, probably in that area. I mean, this is Cape Town. Yeah. It's Cape Town. So you are going to find a venue in that area. And after this story, they'll probably give it for free. Just to say, hey, look at us. We are virtuous. These people deny them. We're going to give them the venue for free. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a venue to have your marriage there, and that's brilliant. That is the market. That is what we've been talking about. It's a beautiful thing where you have choice. Everyone has choice. So if someone chooses not to associate with you, that's also an exercised, valid choice. But the point is there's a lot of choices. Now, just let me be absurd for a second. Mm-hmm. Maybe it won't be absurd for long. The state nationalizes wedding venues, and suddenly we have a homophobe as the president, and he says there will be no recognized lesbian marriages in our wedding venues. You don't have a choice anymore. Mm. It's gone. And that's what the state is doing of sport now. They're nationalizing sport. Mm. So it may not be absurd for too much longer nationalizing wedding venues. But the point is that in liberal thinking, as I said earlier, we tend to be progressive. I think most liberals will say this is really bad. Mm. But you leave them alone, you give them the choice, and you let the market decide. Mm. And in a society like Cape Town, which is almost a society unto itself, a progressive society, they'll reject that. That wedding venue will probably have a lot of social ostracism directed at it over the next few months and years if the state doesn't close it down, God forbid. But the market will deal with it. Mm-hmm. And all the gays and lesbians in this country know now, we're not even going to touch them because they don't accept me for who I am. Mm. So they'll go to other competitors and give them the money.
Absolutely.
That is the liberal response. Now, the leftist idea is that, no, we must all regiment society so that everyone is forced to be progressive. But why would you want that? That is not a valid choice. You're not a true community if you're forced into it. You're not truly progressive if that has been enforced onto you. You are no valid choice has taken place. It's a facade. It's artificial, and nobody should want that.
In fact, I fully agree with your point because I made the point on social media, and I'll juxtapose it against the opposing view from a certain DA MP. But I made the point to say, look, if an establishment doesn't want to serve me for whatever discriminatory reason that they hold, then by golly, I would happily not want to spend my hard-earned cash with them. And I don't really see why we ought to force them to accept my money. Mm. There's plenty of other establishments, as you said, who would gladly take the cash and my patronage. But now you have enter a one Phumzile Van Dam, who is a DA member of Parliament, who basically says, I'm going to bring up a tweet, Martin. Mm. And I'm not really wanting you to necessarily direct a response to her. The who is almost irrelevant. Mm. The idea she articulated. But she basically tweets and says, look, if this had been a refusal to marry on the grounds of race, imagine the anger. But because it's the LGBT, basically the alphabet mafia community, some are defending this. Your religion does not give you the right to discriminate. If you're planning to get married at named venue, stand in solidarity and cancel. Now, that latter bit, I don't mind. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Don't mind that. But what started happening, the first bit I took a little bit of grief with, the idea that, you know, people can't discriminate on the grounds of race or gender or whatever the case may be. Of course people can, and they do every day. Mm-hmm. The issue becomes, should the state punish or step in to punish that individual? And it comes back to, I'll bring in other case examples here, Martin, because I want you to weigh in on it a little bit. I mean, you had a Vicky Momberg, for example, who was arrested essentially for criminal injury, and given a relatively long sentence for that. I mean, I don't think there was a precedent for that. And it's kind of setting a dangerous precedent that you can actually be jailed for words in this country.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, the Vicky Momber case was a total injustice. I mean, what she said was disgusting.
Absolutely.
Like, the fact that she and Penny Sparrow, I mean, they lost everything. Their,
yeah.
Their whole lives fell apart. That is justice. That's great. These people need to be kicked, almost exiled from our society. Mm. But the fact that she was sentenced to jail after having not initiated any type of violence against anyone else,
mm.
Is a perversion of law, and it's a perversion of criminaneuria.
Mm.
I mean, this was a relatively serious case where she belittled the police officer repeatedly for like over a few minutes.
A barrage saying, of the insult.
Yeah, so I mean, it was relatively serious, and if there's a civil case on his part saying that, wow, you really like harmed me, I've had stress, I've had to go to shrinks for the last year, I'm poor because of what you've said to me, mm. then maybe you can say that in our law you have a personality rights-based claim for some kind of compensation mm. from her. Now, I would probably also disagree with that, but I'll say, okay, fair enough. The fact that she has been sent to jail mm. is terribly dangerous, not just in defense of racists,
mm.
but in defense of what's next.
Mm.
The government was very close in 2016 to criminalizing, quote-unquote, insulting people
mm.
or bringing them into ridiculing them or, quote-unquote, bringing them into contempt on the basis of their occupation, on the basis of their beliefs. So imagine this. You insult a racist with the intention of ridiculing them. You have just violated the 2016 version of the hate speech bill, and you can go to jail for mm. up to 5 years. That is insane. I mean, people call it the slippery slope fallacy, but I'm not sure it's always a fallacy.
Mm.
In this country, the government has shown us that when it starts something, it is a slippery slope. Again, going back to the nationalization of sports, we started in 1994 with property rights are important, it's a right in the Bill of Rights, and now we've ended up with the government literally nationalizing an entire industry of people who are engaged in private voluntary interaction. So it is a slippery slope, and it's particularly true when it comes to speech and expression. And we see this with such innocuous things as mm. this association thing about, hi, we don't agree with your choice, please go to our competitors across the road,
mm-hmm.
and government, and I'm sure it will, stepping in and saying, no, this is totally unacceptable. And I've written about this in my legal writing before. The, mm-hmm. the right to freedom of association, Section 18 of the Constitution, basically it doesn't exist. It's dead letter law.
Mm-hmm.
The courts don't recognize it. The commentariat doesn't recognize it. Parliament, these supposed guardians of the Constitution, don't care about it. But there it is. Everyone has a right to freedom of association. Mm. It's a right. It's a human right, firstly, but it's a constitutional right. And it's been totally thrown out the window. And I the person you referred to earlier, I think referred to the Constitution in a later tweet,
mm.
Acting as if her involvement here was in defense of the Constitution, whereas mm. that is totally false. The Constitution, and a Constitution, basically, is all about limiting the scope and power
That's
of
right.
the state and expanding the scope of individual liberty.
Mm.
Now, you cannot say that using the Constitution to restrict the scope of liberty and expand the power of the state is a valid use of it.
Mm.
That's just, again, a perversion of law, as Frederick Bastiat would say.
Absolutely. Martin, we must move on as we sort of wrap up our conversation. And I said we'd look at sort of, you know, economic issues, social issues, and some of the political issues
mm.
Of how a libertarian or a liberty-loving individual, a classical liberal, would view, you know, when I talk about politics, let's look at the role of the state
mm-hmm.
and how big the state should be and how it should be structured, you know, centralized or decentralized.
Yeah.
How would we look at the state and the role of the state? And it's important that we set these all out because I think I'll draw snippets of a lot of what we talked about
mm.
and cut and include them in subsequent shows in as the year goes on
mm.
to show why the principle is important. Mm. So my view, just very briefly in 30 seconds, the state should be as decentralized as possible,
mm.
As close to the people, that is, as possible. And I'm using lefty rhetoric here, close to the people. But essentially, you shouldn't have centralized authority. And if I were to postulate how a South Africa should look like, and you can do the same if you want, it should be as federal as possible, mm-hmm. with each region as having as much autonomy mm-hmm. as possible, local as possible, decentralized as possible, and as least power as mm-hmm. possible, mm-hmm. With the role of the state being really mm-hmm. just limited. But I want you to set it out for us, mm-hmm. the role of the state, the politics in South Africa, how does a libertarian or a liberty-loving guy mm-hmm. Look at it?
Yeah, so there's a lot of debate here. Many people disagree. And my approach to it is basically this. The state as an institution, as a universal institution, I'm not talking about the South African state, but the state as a concept almost, is a very specific institution with a very specific goal that is weaved into its bones. Mm-hmm. And that is to protect people's property and their liberty. Mm-hmm. That is the extent of it. So the example I always give, because I think it's illustrative, is that you will not ask the nursery that you take your children to sanction Iran or to build bombs, because that's ridiculous. Why would you ask the nursery that you take your children to do that? And for me, as a libertarian, that is exactly what I see happening with the state. Here is this institution. Its role is very simple, very clear. Yet it's doing all these wonderful things for everyone. And if you ask something and Parliament agrees, they'll pass a law and, wow, suddenly magic happens. And suddenly it's part of the role of the state. That is, it's beyond ridiculous to me. So as a libertarian, a classical liberal, I would say that the role of the state is simply limited to protecting people's property and protecting their liberty. There is nothing else. So that would apply even on the local level. So I don't think local level should be given as much autonomy as possible, because then we move into what, for lack of a better word, a lot of alt-right libertarians, which I totally disagree with, say, and that is that it doesn't matter what the state does. It just matters that it's very localized. It's localism. I think that's a problem. I think that your local government can oppress you just as hard as any national government. But of course, I agree that decentralization is absolutely part of libertarianism, but not only a geographic decentralization, but also the institutional decentralization. I think Switzerland is a beautiful example. They don't have a single president. Mm. Every year, they have a different president which rotates amongst their federal council. And that system of government is very decentralized. Certain parliaments have upper house veto, which if the lower house, which is usually the commons, the ordinary people, the passions of the moment, send legislation up, the more, this is only the theory, the more experienced statesmen in the upper house can veto it. Now, South Africa doesn't have that. We have a useless institution called the National Council of Provinces, which just puts a rubber stamp on anything the National Assembly sends them, so it's useless. But these are the types of things that libertarians want in their state. They want a president with as little power, if anything, if any power at all. And they want a legislature, or probably no legislature at all, because the idea of creating law is also somewhat odd, because the law is what the law is. And I don't want to bore your listeners with legal history, but the originating idea of a parliament was to simply represent the people, not quote-unquote make law. Mm. Law was not something that the people saw as being made. It's something that just existed, and judges found the law in that specific circumstance. Mm. And Parliament, at the end of the day, codified existing law, and that developed into this idea of creating law. Mm. So the existence of a legislature like Parliament in a libertarian state is up to debate, but if it should exist, the only things that it should be able to do is create legislation that protects your liberty, protects your property, nothing else. And then, of course, I think the most important element in libertarian governance is the court system. Mm. Libertarians are all about avoiding conflict and adjudicating conflict. So we put a lot of emphasis on a good court system, not a centralized court system, but have as many courts as possible. Mm. Almost a competition between courts, and then you'll eventually come to a more reasoned and insightful and better judgment. More you move through the system, that's just the nature of legal development. So this is the idea of the libertarian state. But I think more than just a constitutional change, we absolutely need a mentality change. And the problem in South Africa, around the world, but particularly here, is that we think government is mommy and government is daddy. Mm. And when we have a problem, we must ask them for help. Now, I see a lot of on television, people really have these terrible stories of their businesses falling apart because of government, by the way, but then saying, oh, but government has not done enough to uplift us. And I'm like, you shouldn't be asking for it because you're asking for trouble. So it's a mentality change. We need to find in ourselves and in our communities the solutions to our problems rather than looking to the state, which in our country's history has always and consistently just oppressed the most vulnerable people. And I can promise all the listeners that it will continue to do so unless we have this mentality change and we reduce the state to the small size that it needs to be.
Martin, we've run out of time. How do the people find you?
So I am most active on Facebook, so you can like my page. It is facebook.com/Martin van Staden Liberty, one word, or just search for me, Martin van Staden. I'm on Twitter, that's @Martin_ASFL. I'm not that active there, but you'll find all the necessary information about what I've done, the books I've written, articles I've written on my website. That is www.martinvanstaden.com, one word.
Perfect.
Thanks for having me.
Martin van Staden, of course, is from the Free Market Foundation. A big thank you to him for joining us on the show. And thank you to the listener for listening to this, the first episode of Libertarian Frames for 2020. Guys, remember, we're looking to syndicate this show, and it'll soon be on your local community radio station. So if you have a favorite radio station, ask for them to bring on the Libertarian Frames and the Big Liberty Show to your radio station. But I'll give you more of those details in subsequent shows. Guys, thank you so much. I'm your favorite fat boy, Big Daddy Liberty. Remember, never trust a commie.